reliant upon these things. In none of these campaigns did the Germans outnumber their opponents at the outset, and tank for tank the French in 1940 outclassed the Germans, as did the Soviets in 1941, at least where the T-34 was concerned. The overarching reason why the German army consistently won its early battles and campaigns was its doctrine. The German army was decisively superior in training, tactics, and operations to all the armies it faced between 1939 and 1941. It was the army's superior doctrine that made its training, tactics, and operations so supple, and the army as a whole so resilient. On the broadest level, three things characterized this doctrine. The first was a military ethos that could not have been more different from the cliché of zombie-like obedience popularly ascribed to the German military. The army's concept of Auftragstaktik stressed qualities such as flexibility, daring, and independent thinking. Its most successful proponents knew which qualities to display in which situations, but the effect of Auftragstaktik overall was clear at every level of the army's successful campaigns. It was most visible of all during the German offensive in the West in May 1940. It was on show then in the actions of the infantry squads that crossed the River Meuse in dinghies under French fire before overpowering their opponents' defences on the west bank of the river, and at the far higher level of the operational planning that had gone into the campaign, it was apparent in the audacious scheme to cut through the rear of the Allied armies via the Ardennes. Then there was the stress the German army placed on superior organization. At all levels, the German army was more effectively organized than all the opposing armies it faced during the war's first 2 years. It had superior communications, enabling its field officers to coordinate individual combat engagements more effectively, efficient coordination with the Luftwaffe through its network of liaison officers, and a superior operational command structure that was, for the most part, unafraid to give thrusting subordinate commanders their head, as long as they adhered to broad operational goals. Indeed, these elements of effective organization were integral to Auftragstaktik because they were intended to ensure that, while a subordinate commander could be self-sufficient and aggressive in intent, he would not try anything reckless. The third essential characteristic of the army's doctrine was the stress it placed upon the fighting power and fitness of the individual German soldier. By no means all the army's soldiers were obliged to achieve the same exacting physical standards, but enough were to enable the army to march further or drive further than its early opponents. Another vital component of fighting power was, of course, morale, and during the war's early years the army was assured an ample supply of it. Palpable enthusiasm for National Socialist ideology was stronger among younger soldiers than among their older comrades, but the figure of Hitler personally inspired palpable enthusiasm across age groups. So too did the social and economic policies that were the basis of the Volksgemeinschaft, a supposedly nationwide people's community of which the Wehrmacht as a whole was the self-styled embodiment. Careerism, certainly for professional soldiers, was another motivation. Indeed, careerism and Nazi ideology were intertwined, for both were based on the idea that the strongest and fittest should come to the fore. Soldiers also felt the German public's pride in them, pride founded not just on their victories, but also on the older militaristic values that permeated much of German society. Of course, the German army did not run anything like as smoothly in reality as it did in theory. Among other things, the training of many of its troops betrayed defects even during some of its most triumphant campaigns. Moreover, senior commanders could indeed be reckless. Fortunately for the German army, the ineptitude of its early opponents more than compensated. The military triumphs the German army enjoyed during the war's first 2 years were trumpeted in former generals' post-war memoirs as evidence that it was Hitler himself who had been the main obstacle to complete victory. For it was the dictator's own increasingly destructive conduct of military operations from the summer of 1941 onwards that, they claimed, had brought that succession of victories to a halt. This was the core of the lost victories thesis espoused most famously by Manstein, but also by other former senior commanders. Their other core explanation for the German army's eventual defeat was that, as the run of German victories dried up, the Allied coalition brought to bear its overwhelming material superiority, particularly in air power, to defeat the Wehrmacht through sheer brute strength. Hitler's mismanagement of the army and of the German war effort more widely, still more the Allies' superior and eventually unstoppable numerical and material strength, were indeed pivotal in the German army's defeat. So too, however, were the political, economic, strategic, and operational failings of the army leadership itself. Nor should it be forgotten that the Allies were not just well-resourced during the war's final years, but also increasingly proficient. One area in which the German army never excelled under the Third Reich was grand strategy. In one sense, this was not entirely the army leadership's fault, for it was Hitler who was making the major strategic decisions. On the other hand, the army leadership had consciously and progressively relinquished its ability to shape such decisions during the 1930s. In truth, however, the army leadership had never possessed genuinely sound strategic judgment in the first place. This was also true of its performance during the First World War, albeit less than during the Second. The general whose strategic judgment was soundest during the 1930s was Beck. When he departed the scene in October 1938, the army leadership became even more strategically short-sighted and over-ambitious than its 1914-1918 predecessor. Problematic as Germany's strategic situation was after the fall of France, it did not lack strategic options. However, each of those options brought problems, and in electing to invade the Soviet Union sooner rather than later, Hitler chose the option with the greatest risk. Passively or actively, the generals supported his judgment. Some matched Hitler's overconfidence with their own, and developed or acquiesced in the invasion plan accordingly. Some regarded the prospect of attacking the Soviet Union more cautiously, but largely kept their reservations to themselves. All fell victim to the hubristic groupthink that had grown particularly pronounced within the senior officer corps since the fall of France. Consequently, the months immediately following the invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941 were the first stage of a process in which the army's operational goals began to exceed its practical means. Amid a country so vast and against an army with such enormous reserves of manpower and equipment, the German army's tactical and operational superiority initially made great headway, but the chances of a decisive strategic victory were too slim to countenance realistically. Above all, German strategy against the Soviet Union relied too much upon factors beyond its control. One was Japan, whose reluctance to support Germany against the Soviet Union removed a military factor that might have made a decisive difference. A more important factor was the Soviet Union itself. The generals relied unrealistically, albeit with growing apprehension, upon the Soviet military leadership repeating the same colossal errors it had made at the campaign's start. They also overestimated their own ability, or at least disregarded their inability, to overcome the grueling logistical challenges that invading and occupying the Soviet Union involved. These factors were working against the Germans as early as July 1941, and delayed them long enough to enable the Red Army to survive and counterattack before Moscow in December. Even the failure to destroy the Red Army was not enough on its own to ensure that Germany would actually lose the war. That outcome became far more likely when the United States entered the war during the days when the Germans were being driven back before Moscow. It is tempting to speculate over what would have happened if certain things had gone differently in 1942. Germany and its allies might yet have salvaged something short of complete defeat, at least for several years. What is clear, however, is that the German army itself could no longer affect the course of the war decisively. For as the German army's fighting power was waning, that of its Red Army opponent was waxing, as the Stalingrad debacle showed. The German army had a similar experience elsewhere in 1942, if on a smaller scale, against another opponent that it had similarly bested before, the British-led Eighth Army in North Africa. But the principal front on which the German army would progressively bleed to death between 1941 and 1944 was the Eastern one. Between June 1941 and the end of 1944, more than 2.7 million German military personnel perished there, compared with 766,000 on all other fronts during the same period. But although the Eastern Front was where the German army was broken, the preconditions for its degradation and destruction were also laid down elsewhere by the Western Allies, above all the United States. There were three facets to the contribution that the Western Allies made to the German army's eventual defeat. The first was economic. As well as gifting the Western Allies themselves their eventually overwhelming material superiority in the field, the Allies' economic strength led to Lend-Lease, which went a long way towards supplying the Red Army with the tracks and above all with the wheels that eventually enabled it to thrust westwards unstoppably. The second facet was geographical. At important junctures, the offensives of the Western Allies diverted Hitler's attention, and with it German troops and equipment, to other parts of Europe. It was this in particular that exposed the misconceived nature of the two-headed German high command structure, as the OKH and the OKW tried to pull resources in different directions to profit their respective theatres of war. The third facet was dimensional. The Germans were unable to overcome the Allies decisively either at sea or in the air. The only time they came anywhere close was at various points during the U-boat campaign in the Atlantic, but by the summer of 1943 that was a battle the Germans had clearly lost. From that point on, they had no answer to Allied aerial and maritime superiority. They could no longer disrupt the Allies' ability to supply and protect their own troops through aerial and maritime means, still less withstand the Allies' aerial and maritime onslaught against their own troops. The most profound impact that the Western Allied war effort had upon the German army, however, came from its air power. It was this that compelled the Luftwaffe to commit vast resources to protecting the Reich that otherwise might have protected the Wehrmacht on the front lines. Over time, Allied air power destroyed the economic basis of the German army's fighting power. It also had a more directly devastating impact upon the army's mobility, communications, and supply. Finally, it must also be appreciated that the Allies in both East and West were not just supremely well-resourced during the war's final 2 years, but also increasingly proficient. Whatever the economic and aerial strength backing them, Allied armies needed to take and hold ground in order ultimately to defeat the German army. Ongoing defects aside, their troops became better trained, organized, and coordinated, just as those of the German army eventually became progressively less so. Whether as an institution or in terms of individual units, the German army was complicit in or directly committing crimes from the invasion of Poland onward. The charge sheet against the German army is enormous. It includes the neglect, often willful and often lethal, of millions of civilians and POWs under its control, the brutal conduct of security operations, the economic devastation of occupied Europe, the increasingly murderous victimization of Jews, communists, and other minorities whom Nazi ideology detested, and the indoctrination, brutalization, and, in the war's final phase, terrorization of many of its own rank-and-file troops. Circumstances and ideology went hand in hand to drive the German army's criminality during the period of its victories. For instance, that German soldiers frequently killed surrendering or captured enemy soldiers during the victorious campaigns and operations of the war's first 2 years was partly due to battlefield circumstances and to how soldiers susceptible to combat inexperience, heady triumphalism, or elite self-imagery reacted to those circumstances. Tellingly, however, most of the victims on these occasions were either Poles or black French colonial troops. Yet the worst crimes the army committed, or in which it was complicit, took place between 1941 and 1944. During these years, the terror, exploitation, and criminality in which the German army was involved across Europe, whether at the front line or overwhelmingly more so behind it, were worst when the army's difficulties mounted or when the military fortunes of the army and the Reich went into, or threatened to go into, sharp reverse. This does not for a moment mean that any of these actions were simply compelled by circumstance. It was, to say the least, no coincidence that the army did its worst against ethnic and national populations whom Nazi ideology deemed racially or morally inferior. The army's senior commanders widely subscribed to such ideology. If ordinary soldiers were less uniformly susceptible to it, the positive sense of belonging they felt in the National Socialist Volksgemeinschaft made it easier for them to oppress, exploit, and sometimes terrorize purportedly inferior peoples. Thus did circumstances and ideology go hand in hand to worsen the army's conduct. And much of the glue that bound them together throughout the entire war was provided by the harsh utilitarian view within the army as an institution of what constituted military necessity, a view the army had harbored since at least the First World War. Subjecting this entire process to close scrutiny reveals complex truths about what drove the criminality of the German army's war and what determined the involvement of different individuals and units. As has been made abundantly clear, the army as a whole was complicit in terror, exploitation, and criminality virtually from the war's start. That complicity lowered its moral threshold and made it easier for the army to contemplate even greater complicity in the future. Generally, as the army's difficulties intensified, so did its brutality. In Poland in 1939, for example, a number of senior commanders opposed the mass killings that the SS and police committed. In the Soviet Union in 1941, by contrast, most senior commanders acquiesced in or agreed with such killings, and the great majority of officers who were charged with assisting the SS and police did so readily and often willingly. One motive for all this was political. It did not do to cross swords unnecessarily with an organization that was growing more powerful within the Nazi state's power structure. Army units also had a more general motive for assisting the SS and police, one that emerged because of the course taken by the war. As the war dragged on and the army had to commit to long-term occupation, the SS and police assisted the army's security effort. This development took place on the cusp of a change in the army's fortunes, in the wake of victory, but with a foreshadowing of defeat. The German armies in the east were still advancing, but uncertainty at the campaign's outcome was beginning to infect the sense of triumph, and the army faced increasingly arduous conditions at the front and in the rear. And as the German army became bogged down in the Soviet Union, most of its senior commanders instructed their own units to behave still more ruthlessly, indeed murderously, towards enemy groups in German-occupied territory, not only Jews but also communists, Sinti and Roma, and civilians whom the Germans suspected of supporting partisans. Yet Soviet POWs, Jews and civilians across Eastern and Southern Europe did not die en masse because the army leadership had no other choice. The army leadership and other Reich agencies came to this pass because of conditions they themselves had created. Thus, for example, the army leadership consciously failed to supply its troops in the Soviet Union, make provision for the huge numbers of Soviet POWs it should reasonably have expected, or resource a proper security campaign across occupied Eastern and Southern Europe. Thus, in turn, Soviet civilians starved when German soldiers plundered them, Soviet POWs died in droves in squalid and exposed prison camps, and Eastern and Southern Europeans perished in anti-partisan operations that too often substituted brutality for properly resourced and considered pacification. And in these cases, as in others, a central reason why both the army leadership and commanders in the field considered it necessary to bring these and other dreadful situations to pass was the ideologically suffused contempt they felt for such groups in the first place. The army's sense of military necessity might be what determined its priorities and actions most directly, but Nazi ideology and the harshly utilitarian attitudes that the German army had long held in matters of military occupation were crucial in determining what the army considered necessary militarily. Yet given that, among other things, the bulk of German army personnel encompassed every segment of German society and geography, the question of how far different individuals and units were inclined to brutality and complicit in the army's damning charge sheet is complex and differentiated. Many officers and soldiers at all levels of the German army felt contempt, indeed loathing, for groups such as communists, Jews, Eastern Slavs, Serbs, Roma, and particularly from 1943, Italians. At best, they treated such groups callously. At worst, they terrorized them or were directly or indirectly involved in their mass murder. Nazi ideology and higher-level directives fueled such attitudes and actions at all levels of the army. but soldiers and officers were not all equally susceptible to these influences. To take just two examples, a middle-ranking officer with an upper-middle-class background and genuine religious convictions was likely, all else being equal, to be less influenced by Nazi ideology than a middle-ranking officer with a lower-middle-class background and no religious convictions. Even more importantly, an officer was likely to be even less susceptible if he hailed from an older age group. By contrast, a younger officer with no formative experiences before the Third Reich and the chaotic final years of the Weimar Republic was more likely to be seduced by Nazi ideology. When compared with the last years of Weimar, the early years of the Third Reich were generally a satisfying and secure period for the great majority of Germans. One did not need to be a Nazi fanatic during these years in order to feel well disposed towards Hitler, or to buy into the ideology he espoused and the new Volksgemeinschaft that the Nazis claimed to have founded. It was even easier to be seduced when one was too young to have memories of an earlier time. Thus, some units behaved less callously or barbarically than others in the same situation. To take one example, during the army's earlier campaigns, older soldiers were less inclined to torment Jews than their younger comrades were. To take another, ordinary frontline infantry units assigned to anti-partisan operations in southern Europe were less likely to lash out against pro-bandit populations than were elite units like panzer or mountain divisions. More generally, a unit commander's social influences and life experiences could radicalize or restrain him. Where a unit or a commander came from could also play a role. Certainly, the Austrian commander of the Austrian units that mass-executed their way across Serbia in 1941 actively incited his troops' historical enmity towards Serbs. By contrast, Austrian units of the German army were known to comport themselves relatively mildly during the opening months of the campaign against the Soviet Union. But a unit such as the 221st Security Division, hailing from a pro-Nazi region of Germany that had experienced enmity with the East firsthand, comported itself during that period in a manner that was anything but restrained. More fundamentally, however, a unit's behavior was shaped by where, when, and in what function it was serving. Overall, the Army's relatively few occupation units were more complicit in crimes than the Army's far more numerous frontline units. Its harshest conduct of all was in the Soviet Union and the Balkans, and it was occupation units that were primarily responsible. However, this does not mean that only a relatively small, neatly self-contained minority of the Army's soldiers perpetrated its crimes. For one thing, that minority too was diverse. Two cases from the Soviet Union exemplify this. Firstly, mobile anti-partisan units were involved in plundering and destroying pro-partisan villages, but static territorial units composed of older soldiers guarded POW camps. Secondly, a territorial unit guarding a POW camp in the summer of 1942 would have been far less complicit in the death of Soviet POWs than a territorial unit guarding such a camp in the dreadful winter of 1941 to 1942. Further, frontline units also committed crimes. The heat of battle may have prompted some of the crimes that units committed at the front itself, but other crimes are less neatly explained. German soldiers frequently killed freshly captured Red Army soldiers during 1941, partly because of the heat of battle and the Red Army's frequent killing and mutilation of its German prisoners, but also partly because the criminal orders incited German soldiers to be ruthless towards the enemy. When it came to anti-partisan warfare, several examples from southern Europe suggest that the worst offenders among frontline units were those that harbored an elite self-image, and whose personnel extensively comprised younger recruits more thoroughly indoctrinated than their elders. Finally, although the Soviet Union and southern Europe suffered the worst terror and rapacity, large numbers of the Army's occupation troops were stationed in parts of Europe that, though they led a grim existence, were less hard hit by German occupation. The style of occupation that the German Army conducted in Western Europe was certainly connected to the brutal war it was waging in the East. The ripple effects of Operation Barbarossa upon reprisal policy in France during the second half of 1941 testify to this. And across much of Western Europe as elsewhere, the German army was involved in the victimization, deportation, and eventual extermination of Jewish populations. However, connected though the western and eastern sides of the German army's war were, they were also distinct. The German army's occupation of Western Europe did become more severe and exploitative over time, but there were certain constraints upon it that were stronger there than in Eastern or Southern Europe. There were worlds of difference, for instance, between an officer conducting anti-partisan operations near Smolensk and an officer garrisoned on static occupation duty in Copenhagen. The former might be killing racially inferior civilians every day in the course of brutal security operations. The latter might be enjoying coffee and cakes every day among people who, according to Nazi propaganda, were the Germans' racial kinsmen, and who, until late 1942, were generally disinclined to resist the occupation. Some occupation units would experience both extremes at different times in the war, and many would experience numerous states in between. Among the army's generals, proportionally more individuals, at the front and in the rear, were involved at some time or other in some aspect of policy that resulted in the killing, terrorization, or exploitation of civilians. This was in the ruthless, indeed criminal, wider nature of the war Nazi Germany was waging. For this reason, to take one example, while most German generals serving in the occupied Soviet Union were old-school conservatives rather than convinced Nazis, they were nevertheless complicit in ruthless Nazi occupation policies. Of course, an officer whose tenure as a general might only encompass the 2 months of the Normandy campaign before he was taken prisoner could plead considerably more innocence than one who had directly ordered the mass execution of Serbian Jews in 1941. Overall, however, a majority of generals were culpable to some extent, for the great majority served at one time or another in the Soviet Union, in the campaign that saw both frontline and occupation units inflict the greatest terror and hardship upon civilians. Between the summer of 1943 and the spring of 1945, the German army's fighting power ebbed away, steadily and then rapidly, but it managed to continue the struggle throughout. To understand how and why this happened when eventual defeat was inevitable, it is impossible to separate military considerations from moral ones. The growing prominence of a new crop of ruthless, hard-bitten field commanders stiffened the army's resistance on the battlefronts. So did the defensive skills of units in the field, nurtured in an environment that still contained enough veterans who had been schooled in and could in turn impart the characteristic qualities of German army training, the army's increasingly vicious system of discipline, the hardening effect of prolonged combat, particularly in the East, and a generally harsh, ideologically suffused mentality. A vital force that drew all these threads together was the particularly pronounced military ethos that distinguished the German army from its opponents, particularly the citizen armies of the Western Allies. All these characteristics together helped to instill within the German army, from the winter of 1941 to 1942 onwards, a National Socialist conception of warfare. This conception aimed not only to radicalize the soldiers politically, but also to toughen them physically and mentally in the face of the increasingly arduous conditions they faced. In one sense, National Socialist warfare was a sign of failure, because it was trying to compensate for the fact that the German army was no longer winning. But by hardening the troops, it helped to delay defeat. Of course, the spirit of National Socialist warfare also drew on the hard-bitten urge to survive. This was perhaps the most fundamental factor of all, particularly in the merciless environment of the Eastern Front, and particularly when the soldiers in question were also motivated by more universal feelings of comradeship with their fellows. As a result of all this, the German army units exhibited great staying power in defense. They also exhibited great resourcefulness and flexibility. The most successful defensive commanders of the final 2 years of the war, men such as Model, Schirner, and Kesselring, were able to harness such qualities even as they scorned or disregarded the moral questions surrounding the brutality of the other measures they employed to shore up the line. Meanwhile, whilst the maneuver warfare favoured by the likes of Manstein no longer had any strategic value from 1943 onwards, officers on the next command level down, such as Bulk, successfully harnessed it in the cause of flexible defense in their sectors. Thus did the army's approach to defense during the war's last 2 years also owe much to the principles of Auftragstaktik. More importantly still, from the summer of 1943 until the summer of 1944, the German army's replacement system and the German war economy still functioned well enough for the field army to continue the fight. Between then and early 1945, however, they began to decline sharply. That said, both had been under strain before the summer of 1944, the war economy due to Allied bombing and the replacement system due to spiraling casualty rates. In 1943 and 1944, the Wehrmacht as a whole suffered as many fatalities as it did during the rest of the war combined. The raw figures for the army are even starker. It suffered 67,000 war dead in 1940, for example, compared with more than 700,000 in 1943 and almost 1.5 million in 1944. Yet even after the disasters of the summer of 1944, there remained enough quality manpower and equipment, both in the field and in the system, to delay the army's demise. By early 1945, however, the replacement system and the war economy were in their death throes, and the military might of the Allies was overwhelming. During January 1945, the Wehrmacht as a whole suffered more fatalities than in any other month of the war. After that, the replacement system disintegrated. As the army's remaining military effectiveness drained away, so its casualty rate spiked for one final devastating time, as it suffered more than a million further fatalities during 1945. The answer to the question of why the German army fought on as long as it did was an answer that evolved and changed during the war's final 2 years. By February 1943, and by the summer of 1943 at the very latest, the great majority of officers and soldiers at all levels knew that Germany could not win the war outright. Fearful of the potential consequences of defeat for themselves, their families, and their homeland, they now sought to ensure that Germany did not lose outright either. Such hopes and fears were still intertwined with the pernicious influence of National Socialist belief. Among the mass of soldiers in the field, the most potent conveyors of a doctrine combining Nazi ideology with military values was the army's increasingly youthful, socially diverse junior frontline officers and NCOs. Between the autumn of 1943 and the summer of 1944, officers and soldiers also harbored hopes of frustrating the Western Allies long enough to split the Allied coalition or secure a negotiated peace, together with the help of the new Wunderwaffen on which the Führer was supposedly working. The Wehrmacht would then transfer the bulk of its forces to take on the Red Army in the east. Such hopes were largely destroyed by the disasters of the summer of 1944. After that, and the failure of the bomb plot of July 1944, enough officers and soldiers were too frightened by the prospect of defeat and by the terror emanating from their own side to contemplate abandoning the fight. To some extent, they still sought solace in the figure of Hitler and the prospect of miracle weapons. But even if they had not, the army as a whole was now too straitjacketed by the regime to take any independent action to end the war sooner. Following the failure of the Ardennes offensive in January 1945, the army's supply of manpower and materiel collapsed. Senior officers with memories of the defeat of 1918 and with a sense of shame that some of their colleagues had tried to assassinate the Führer the previous summer, endeavored to keep the fight going for honor's sake and cajoled or terrorized their men into doing likewise. Eventually, however, most officers and soldiers kept on fighting simply to stay both sane and alive. They stopped when they were no longer physically capable or when actually ordered to by their superiors. This, in turn, only happened after Hitler himself was dead, for it was only then that the integrating force of the Führer's figure disappeared and extinguished the final twitchings of both regime and army. When it came to its moral conduct, the German army as a whole was a diverse entity during the war's final 2 years, as it had been before. Yet regardless of which units, individuals, or command levels behaved more, less, or not at all barbarically during this final phase of the war, the exigencies of Germany's increasingly desperate situation caused army commands to inflict new miseries upon large swaths of occupied Europe. Many officers and men also felt they could morally justify such things as scorched earth campaigns in the Soviet Union and brutal anti-partisan sweeps in Italy because they saw them as necessary to Germany's continued survival. In other words, officers and men adhered to the principle of harsh military necessity more strongly felt than ever. To such a mindset, the resulting suffering of non-German civilians was irrelevant, considering both what German civilians were suffering under Allied bombing, and even more importantly because of what Germany as a whole might suffer in the event of its defeat. Of the mentality of German society during the second half of the war, Nicholas Stargardt writes, "The Manichaean metaphors of either-or, to be or not to be, everything or nothing, victory or destruction, had a long rhetorical history in Germany. They had constituted Hitler's central ideas since Germany's defeat in 1918, and had been staples of First World War propaganda. The turn in German fortunes changed extremist rhetoric into sound common sense. In the wake of Allied terror bombing, the fundamental existential threat, to be or not to be, acquired a disturbing literalness. People not only had to scrap their earlier expectations and prognoses about the course of the war, they also shed traditional moral inhibitions. Germans did not have to be Nazis to fight for Hitler, but they would discover that it was impossible to remain untouched by the ruthlessness of the war and the apocalyptic mentality it created." Much the same could be said about the German army during the war's final 2 years, even though it had already shed its moral inhibitions to a great extent well before that. But certainly the even harsher, more desperate notion of military necessity that now animated it lowered those inhibitions still further. Thus did the army's military failure further reinforce its brutality. And in one sense, an infernal feedback mechanism ensured that such brutality in turn reinforced the army's military failure further still. For the army's ruthless and rapacious actions during the war's final 2 years, like earlier outrages the forces of the Third Reich had perpetrated during the time of their victories, hardened and indeed brutalized the enemy's own resolve to destroy the Third Reich. Just one illustration of this, and of the bitter, vengeful resolve it engendered, was the sight of burning Russian villages that greeted Red Army troops during 1943 and 1944 as they advanced westwards across a landscape devastated by the Germans' scorched earth campaign. Red Army propagandists spared no effort in exploiting the troops' outrage at this spectacle, using it to stoke further their hatred of the enemy and their determination to seize him by the throat once they had him cornered. This feedback mechanism was not the principal reason why the German army was ultimately destroyed, but it demonstrates how the German army's moral failure and military failure reinforced one another, as indeed they had also been reinforcing one another during the period of German triumph. For it was the hubris the army leadership shared with the Nazi regime following the fall of France in 1940 that helped to precipitate its commitment to a new invasion, this time of the Soviet Union, for which it was unprepared militarily. Partly as a means of trying to make good the army's shortcomings during the campaign that followed, it was increasingly prepared to implement the most ruthless measures. Yet that very same ruthlessness played a key role in hardening Soviet resistance to the German invaders. Thus did the German army's moral failure and military failure reinforce one another through the years of its victories as well as throughout the years of its retreat and eventual destruction. This concludes Hitler's Soldiers by Ben H. Shepherd, narrated by Michael Page. Copyright 2016 by Ben H. Shepherd. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Yale University Press and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.